Well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming, particularly the panelists, and particularly the panelists that have come from out of town. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about this material. I'm going to start this by trying to set up, frame up the discussion. We're looking at pieces of legislation that look out over the next 40 years, and people are taking a stab at trying to guess what 40-year policies might cost. And which is a rather daunting proposition. So I'm going to try to frame all this by just showing you a snapshot of the whole range of policy, many of the policy proposals and many scenarios that are of these various policy proposals, what they look like in the year 2030, about halfway out over this 40-year period that people are talking about, and just give you a flavor for what they look like and what we might know, what we know from them. So what I want to show you here is this is the year 2030. And as you can see, there are a whole bunch of different points, and each one of those represents a scenario of a bill or a proposal of some sort. And what I'm showing you here is the percent reductions in greenhouse gases that occur in the domestic economy in this scenario and the permit price associated with that. Now, many of these scenarios also involve international offsets, they involve domestic sequestration, but what I'm showing here, it doesn't involve sequestration, doesn't involve international offsets, it's just the reductions that you get in the domestic economy from greenhouse gases. So for instance, you look at, say, just a little bit over $20 a ton, say $25 a ton, you've got a couple of these scenarios that get maybe 15% reductions in total greenhouse gas emissions, others that get close to 30, right? A 30% reduction, you've got some of these policies have about a $20 a ton permit price, but some of them approach $60 a ton for permit price. So the green diamonds and squares here just give you the various analyses that have been done of McCain-Lieberman with different amounts of trading, different amounts of offsets, and so on. The diamonds are Bingaman, or various versions of Bingaman that have been analyzed, and the purple square is the National Commission on Energy Policy proposal, the full policy proposal. And the little blue circles are the various MIT scenarios that have been done, right? So the point I would just want to get to, as two points to make with this, the crucial ones, is one is you've got a rising supply curve for emission reductions, right? The more emission reductions you try to get, the more expensive it will be. But at the same time, you see that there's really quite a bit of uncertainty about what a permit price will actually get you at any given time, or what a particular percent reduction will cost you in terms of a permit price. Why do you get so much difference? Well, in that picture you just saw, the differences are primarily due to five things. One is the baselines. The more rapid your emissions grow in the baseline, the more expensive it is to get a 15 or 20% cut. A very big difference is assumptions about how the policy is implemented. So if there are differences in cost of achieving a particular reduction, depending on the amount of coverage, depending on how much flexibility firms and households have in the timing of their reductions and so forth, and all of that matters quite a bit. The models also differ quite a bit in how flexibly they assume that households and firms will respond to policies. And one very important thing is the assumption that they make about how firms evaluate the trade-off in emission reductions today and tomorrow. That is, how they discount the future. Another very important issue is what assumptions are built into the analyses about what technologies will be available and when they'll be available. And those are basically just model judgments and modelers' judgments oftentimes. And finally, something that Jake will talk about in some detail, is that a very, very large determinant of cost for the U.S. is what you assume about what other countries will be doing. And if other countries aren't doing that much and you have international trading, then it's real easy to buy permits. But also, it's also easy to import biofuels if other countries aren't doing that much. So that matters too. I'll pass on from there. Now, this picture is just intended to show you. Oh, one thing also, there's another thing that's not built into that story that you just saw, and that's there's no story about revenue recycling, right? That's all assuming basically lump sum recycling of revenue. So that's a whole other element of what things might cost. Probably wouldn't affect permit prices, but it would probably affect macroeconomic costs. Now, this is intended to show for all the scenarios that have either sequestration, biosequestration, or international offsets allowed, These are the reductions that you get in the permit prices. And the point of this, again, is to say there are three things here. One is it still costs something to do something, and the more you try to do, the more it costs. The second thing is it tends to cost less if you get reductions outside of the country or if you get reductions out of sequestration. And finally, there's still quite a bit of dispersal. Now, for the losses to the economy as a whole, I want to show you here consumption losses. This is reductions in personal consumption expenditures. It's a somewhat better measure of impacts on material welfare than GDP is. And this shows you the stories without without international offsets. And as you can see, again, you know, it costs more to do more. And there's still a lot of dispersal. You got one point that's considerably out of the rest of them. I'm not exactly sure why, and I'll have to figure that out at some point. The other point to make with this is that, as we've said before, as you heard in the previous panel, the overall costs in terms of consumption losses are really fairly modest, even for pretty significant cuts in emissions. In the worst case here, in that very large cut, that 2.5% consumption losses is equivalent to expected consumption growth in a single year in over this period. So it gives you a sense of the magnitude. Now here's with international trading, and you see, of course, that you can get significantly greater emissions at lower consumption prices or lower consumption losses. So there's a lot of uncertainty. So what robust insights can we get out of this? I see basically three near-term and three long-term. I think our panelists will have more to add to this, and they probably have differences of opinion about this. But I will say my take on this whole range of models is first that the most of the reductions will not come out of energy demand, right? Most energy demand doesn't decline that much in these scenarios in the near term, at least through 2025. So the demand responses are relatively modest. Where you get most of the reductions are in the electric utility sector. And where you get them is out of fuel switching, either from coal into natural gas or from technology shifts, such as increases in generation from nuclear. That's where the bulk of the energy sector response occurs. And biological sequestration and international offsets can get you significant reductions at relatively modest costs, assuming that the administrative costs of doing so are relatively low and that there's relatively low mitigation effort in the countries where you're trying to buy offsets. In the long term, that is after 2025 or so, in the beginning of the period that you saw for these graphs, offsets become increasingly less important. That is, most of the reductions that you get have to come out of the energy sector and do in these modeling scenarios. The types of technology that become available in the energy sector are really quite critical, but there's not an obvious consensus in what would become available over time. Looking at the set of studies altogether, it looks to me as though what you're looking at is some kind of combination of responses that are primarily a gradual availability of carbon capture and sequestration, to some degree nuclear, if it's available, if it's allowed to be available, and biofuels, some of which would be imported, or much of which might be imported. And other renewables and conservation would play a role, but they would play relatively limited roles compared with those other technologies. So with that, I will leave this to the rest of the speakers. In your handout, you also have a reference so you can find the various analyses online that we're referring to here.
Okay, thank you very much, and let me say thank you to CBO for the invitation to come here and the opportunity to go through some of EPA's work and try to provide some insights to the assembled crowd. I'm Francisco Delachene from EPA, it says there, but just in case nobody got that. Okay. So I think this is, I think, probably a little bit obligatory in this kind of a conference to show this picture, which I think pretty much everybody is somewhat familiar with. And this is, you know, sort of the traditional way of taking a first comparison of the various proposals that are in Congress at the moment. And so essentially this is comparing the cap levels in the various bills to reference emissions, and this is going to be all greenhouse gases for the U.S. This one goes back to 1990, going out to 2050. And you know, you can see that by the various colors, the bill's under consideration. Now in EPA, we've analyzed the Lieberman-McCain bill. We're in the process of analyzing, and should be completing soon, the Bingaman-Spector bill, the more recent one. And we've just received a new request to analyze the Lieberman-Warner bill. So we'll be pretty busy. So again, this is sort of the traditional look in comparison of this. But I will say, though, it's difficult to compare these bills. They're very complex. They don't all cover the same thing. And there's a lot of really interesting provisions. I think the staff can get really creative in what they put into them. So here's our analysis of the Lieberman-McCain bill. And this is sort of what you can get when you actually have a lot of good data, at least we would say it's good data, on all the greenhouse gases from all the different sectors within the U.S. economy, and also some emissions and mitigation data from outside the United States. So what you have here is essentially the runs from the Adage model that is run for us by Martin Ross, who's in the audience back there. He's from RTI. And also the iGEM model that's run by Dick Gettle and his associates. So here you've got reference emissions, and those are the two top dash lines from 2010 all the way to 2050. And then you've got that black stair step line, and that those are essentially right from the bill. Those are the cap levels right from the reading of the bill. And then things get a little bit more complicated. The blue and green lines that sort of trace near the black stair step case, that is essentially sort of the level of mitigation action taken by the covered entities in the bill. And because there's banking and borrowing allowed for in this bill, the total area under those three lines is the same. So essentially, the cumulative emissions or the cumulative emission reductions in the three bills will be the same. Now what you have to do, though, is you have to add on top of that the emissions from the non-covered entities in the non-covered sectors. So for example, there's emissions from the agricultural sector, there's residential household emissions. And then in the particular case of McCain-Lieberman bill, there's also the provision for international credits. So by U.S. entities benefiting from lower cost mitigation options overseas, they then can sort of displace what they need to do domestically, and in effect sort of raises the U.S. emissions. From a global perspective, if you've got a good system, the total environment should see the same picture, but that brings into question how good your measuring, monitoring, and verification is going to be. So when you sort of factor all that into the analysis, what you see is the top, sort of in the middle, these two blue and green solid lines, which essentially put you at about a 25% reduction from U.S. reference emissions in 2030 and about 44% reduction in 2050. Now, if you look at that picture and you compare that to the one I showed before, it's a very different picture because you have to take into account sort of all the things that I just mentioned. So I've been sort of trying to rack my brain about, well, what would be maybe a little bit more straightforward way of trying to compare the bills, and I came up with this, and this is maybe more sort of illustrative than anything else. But so what I've done here is, on the left side, I said, okay, well, what is the percent reduction from the emissions from the covered sectors to the cap. Okay, and that's the maroon bars. Okay, and on the other side, on the right side, it says, okay, well, given those emissions within the cap sector, how does that compare to the total emissions that are projected? And essentially, you see that when you make the comparison of just what's capped to total, you're going to get a little bit of a higher percentage. Now, in the case of the Lieberman-McCain bill, we actually sort of ran all the provisions for the offsets and international credits. We ended up at these black lines, and this is for 2030 and for 2050. And so essentially you can see that where you actually end up, given all the provisions, you know, a little bit below 30%, that's about 25% that I showed before, it's actually appreciably less than what you would see from face value from reading the bill and from doing that comparison of just plotting out all the cap levels compared to total reference case. So I'm still trying to find the best way to put all the bills in an equal footing. And this is something I'm proposing might be a way to do it, something to maybe keep in mind. Okay, so I'm basically focusing on where the emissions come from. And in the case of our modeling, since we have all the sectors and all the greenhouse gases in our systems, we could show the various sectors and then not just CO2, but also the non-CO2 gases, which include methane, nitrous oxide, and so on. So as Bob said, you know, the majority of the reductions come from the power generation sector, and that's shown in this fairly large dark blue segment. Then we've also got the covered entities and the covered sectors in these multicolor bands that are in the solid. And then we've also have here in this shaded area are the domestic offsets and the international credits. Now, in this particular case, you can see that this large top part, sort of light blue, that's international credits. And in the early part of the bill analysis, the international credits are almost as large as the reductions that you're getting domestically. And then over time, the decline, and that's primarily because of the assumptions that we made about the other countries are taking action to reduce emissions. And then you get sort of a competition for global reductions. I think I'm almost sort of finished on this, but the other important point I wanted to highlight is the importance of the technology that's been stated a couple of times already. So now this is a little bit more careful look at the power generation sector, just looking at the adage model. And what you have here, sort of the reference case in terms of power generation, and you've got a traditional fossil, nuclear, and renewables. And then on the right side, you see, okay, what happens in the policy case? And two things stand out. One is a significant growth in nuclear power, and that was sort of an exogenous assumption on our part, were essentially tripled between 2005 and 2050. But then the importance of carbon capture and storage for the power generation sector, which is that sort of maroon wedge that essentially shows that by the end of the analysis, by 2050, you pretty much have full saturation of this technology in the power generation sector. So now, important to keep in mind, you know, this is sort of one of those silver bullets. Nobody has one of these things built at scale. We all hope they're going to work, and if they don't work, prices and costs are going to be much higher than what we showed. One more minute. Okay, I think this, I'm going to, this is a little bit similar to what Dick Gettle showed, but essentially looking at the various sectors. So I focused on the power generation sector. Here I'm just going to quick picture on what happens to the other key sectors in the economy, and we sort of rank these in terms of the sort of total output. And so obviously for those sectors of the economy that are not very energy intensive, the economic hit is very slight. When you get into petroleum refining, gas, and coal, there's an appreciable economic reduction or out, reduction in output. Now, coal mining is an interesting story. If you have carbon capture and storage, coal could rebound as that technology comes in place. If you don't, then that level of reduction in output will be about, you know, you could be if that doesn't work out as well as we all hope. And I'll end right there.
How do I get off the... Okay, got it. Start my clock yet there. Tough show here. I'd like to thank Peter Orszag and Bob Shackleton for inviting me to be here today. For those of you who don't know us, EIA is the independent statistical and analytical agency within the Department of Energy. EIA doesn't promote, formulate, or take positions on policy issues, and our views shouldn't be construed as representing those of the department or the administration. It pains me to waste time saying that, but I must. My plan for the talk is rather ambitious. I want to make about 10 points in about 10 minutes, drawing on the body of recent and pending analyses at EIA related to greenhouse gas mitigation. So it'll be fast, and hopefully we can deal with clarifying questions. Oops. Too fast. Okay, this pie chart has one simple point. About 4/5 of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are energy-related emissions from the combustion of fossil fuels. That's quick. This one zeroes in on the energy-related emissions. The history side of this figure shows that the electric power generation and transportation account for nearly all of the growth in energy-related emissions since 1990, while emissions from direct fuel use in residential, commercial, and industrial sectors have been flat. The projection side of this shows the same trend is expected to continue through 2030 in EIA's reference case, which assumes that current laws and policies continue indefinitely. Sort of an unlikely case, but the one we look at. Two overarching themes are consistently suggested by recent and pending analyses done by EIA and by others. First, although non-energy related emissions account for less than 20% of total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, reductions outside the energy sector are an important first step in a cost-effective reduction program. However, reductions from energy necessarily play an increasing role as the emission reduction target is tightened. And second, and many have already commented on this, the electricity sector, particularly projected coal use, is most significantly affected. This slide just shows how placing a value, I don't say whether it's a tax or a permit, doesn't really matter, of $10 per ton or $50 per ton on carbon dioxide emissions affects the delivered price of the different fossil fuels. The first two columns simply show you for each fossil fuel what the CO2 content is and what the delivered price actually was in 2005. That's data. The last four columns show the absolute and percentage impacts on the cost of using each fuel associated with a $10 or $50 value. Those are arbitrary, but they sort of represent the range identified in recent modeling analyses of a variety of bills, including S-280 and 1766. Clearly, the percentage impact of a carbon dioxide value on delivered coal prices is greater than the impacts on oil prices and natural gas in percentage terms. This really reflects two things. One, the difference in carbon content, and two, the lower price of coal relative to those other fuels. And by the way, a $25 value somewhere in between there raises gasoline prices by about 23 cents a gallon. And the difference between, I think, the percentage impacts on coal and gasoline has some implications for where the energy response to a cap and trade program comes from. So this is one slide that's from a specific analysis. It's from our S-280 analysis. I guess if you compare the reference case and the S-280 bars in 2020 and 2030, you see that the electricity sector, there's the bottom part of the yellow bars in each, the bottom part of the bar in each case, is really where the energy adjustment is occurring. Again, several reasons. 90% of the coal is used in the electricity sector. We saw what happens to coal prices. While coal-fired electricity generation is a major source of current and projected emissions, there are a lot of alternative, no and low emissions technologies demonstrated already, nuclear, wind, you know, biomass, and others being developed. Changes in electricity generation fuels don't require large changes in distribution infrastructure for electricity using equipment. You don't really, you have a toaster, you don't have to change it if we decide to generate electricity a different way. You don't have these chicken and egg problems that bedevil some of the other sectors, like the transportation sector, if you want to go to some new fuels. And again, recent U.S. experience and high fuel prices over an extended period of time in Europe and other world regions suggests that transportation technology alternatives are not likely to be induced by 23 cents a gallon. Because you know, we've seen prices in Europe, let's say, be dollars a gallon higher than ours for a long time. So these are some of the reasons that underlie the results that I think everybody gets. Our electricity prices, I guess I'd point out that regional impacts vary. I think it's already been touched upon. Not everyone's in the same boat. Maybe it doesn't make a difference, but I have a feeling in this part of town, it makes a difference. So I gave you the map on top so you could correspond those regions to the... Here's a point on capacity additions in the electric sector, and I am focusing on electricity given the importance of electricity to this. Not surprisingly, if you limit greenhouse gases, you're going to change the mix of projected capacity additions. Projected coal bills are reduced dramatically. That's the black, the bottom of the reference case, while nuclear and renewable additions grow substantially. Certainly, capacity additions can also be sensitive to limitations that are unrelated to greenhouse gas reduction. Models can't really tell you, I don't think, how non-economic factors will indicate what's possible. For instance, some people think you can't add nuclear. So we did a case where we capped nuclear at the reference case level and saw what happened. That's the so-called no nuclear case. In that case, you get more renewable and you get some coal with carbon capture and sequestration. We don't get coal with carbon capture and sequestration in our reference case out to 2030. So we can all have different views of what's possible. But one thing that's definitely clear is that with greenhouse gas limitation, there's a need to build more new capacity than is projected in the reference case. That's very important. So definitely the mix changes, but you got to build more in either of those two other cases, and in any case you could think of. And one of the reasons you have to build more is that you have to retire existing coal units that would continue to operate in the reference case. So I think this is a major challenge, not to modelers, but in reality, thinking about this, you know, in a world where NIMBY and banana, you know, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody, comes into effect, you know, I kind of think, like, even building what's in the reference case seems pretty tough. And now you got to build more. So I think that's a robust observation. This is an effort that looks sort of at concern about substitution from coal to gas, been identified by a major concern by some groups. Certainly, it's an option for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in power generation. If you take account of both efficiency differences and carbon per unit of energy, baseload natural gas generation would have about a third the emissions of baseload coal generation. Certainly, that's an advantage for natural gas relative to coal, but natural gas is still significantly disadvantaged relative to no emission options. And in addition, you know, to emissions costs, you also got to worry about fuel costs, and gas is a lot more expensive than coal, and you got to worry about the cost of constructing new capacity. So the top of this thing looks at a situation where you don't have to worry about the cost of constructing new capacity. Just looks at the fuel costs and the permit costs. And it says, how do those change as the carbon value? So on the axis here, the carbon value is zero, and you want to run your existing pulverized coal plant. It's a pretty good deal relative to gas running a combined cycle plant at $6 a million BTU gas. Some people think EIA's gas prices are too low. Doesn't really matter for this point. So I also show you $8 a million BTU. If you start to have a carbon value, you know, the coal line is steeper for the reasons we discussed, and they do cross eventually, but they kind of cross way out there. The kind of values we're talking about are pretty high. The next construct is kind of similar, except it incorporates capital costs as well. And you see the same basic structure. The coal line is steeper than the gas lines. The levels are different because the coal plant is a lot more expensive than the gas plant. So when you put, you know, capital costs in there, you have that deal. But the one thing to keep in mind is that the crossover point comes earlier between coal and gas, but, you know, coal and gas are both pretty high relative to these no emission generation options. So, you know, I think that's something to keep in mind here. Energy, you know, we're talking about greenhouse here. I could do it, I think. Energy security and greenhouse gas emission reduction, there's some synergies and some conflicts. So improved vehicle efficiency probably helps both. Biomass is kind of tricky because you actually get more bang for your buck by, in a greenhouse sense, by using biomass to generate electricity. But in terms of worrying about reducing oil use, you would probably want to use it in place of liquid fuels, coal to liquids, great for reducing oil import dependence, not so hot for greenhouse gases. There's a whole lot going on here. The state of energy technology matters. So EIA, we have a sort of a baseline view of how energy technology progresses, but we also have some alternative views that we can run. And, you know, it's cheaper if you have more favorable assumptions about technology. You lower the costs and projected allowance prices in two ways. First, you lower the projected baseline energy consumption trend. And second, you make emission reductions from that lower trend more responsive to putting a carbon value on. So energy technology really matters. And then finally, let me talk about the framing of economic impacts, because this bedevils us. We're often asked about the effects of greenhouse gas limitation on the economy. We certainly find there are some losses. We generally show larger impacts on consumption than on GDP. In our S280 thing, I think we found consumption in 2030 and GDP down by about 0.4%. The cumulative losses from 2009 to 2030 were like $533 billion for GDP and $487 billion for consumption. The numbers in the figure here that represents two earlier analyses are really want to illustrate one key point that I want to leave you with. The same estimated economic effects from any given analysis can be framed to sound either large or small. You know, GHG issue is a problem of unprecedented scale in terms of its implications for our energy system, but the scale of the economy is also really big. So in this case, looking at two examples of a $542 billion loss and a $1 trillion loss from these two things that we did a while ago, and you know, those are big numbers. If you look on the other hand, saying what difference does it make to the cumulative present discounted value of GDP, you know, in one case it's $186 trillion, in another case it's $185.9 trillion. So again, how you frame these things really matters a lot. And given the time constraints, I'll stop here and leave you to review the final two slides on your own. But I would definitely worry about the second point on the first slide about details, which is how policy design affects incentives for ex post behavior, because I think that's something that is really ignored a lot. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks to Peter and Bob, and we've had a really good overview of this, of all this from Paco and Howard. So what I'll try to do is to use some results from our work to cast perhaps some additional insights to initiate the discussion. And our approach to this has been the following. When we did this work last spring, we have all these various bills, and we thought at the time that they were going to be moving around over time, and of course they're still moving around over time. So the way we approach this question is we defined the three synthetic bills, one which was 203, so you can classify these bills roughly in terms of their stringency according to how many billion metric tons of carbon they allow between 2005 and 2050. So we classified them that way. The 203 is very close to McCain-Lieberman or Lieberman-Warner if they were covering all sectors rather than partially, as Paco mentioned. 287, we at the time we did it, was closer to Bingaman, and although that's changed over time. And the Tunner 67 is closer to sort of the Boxer and such. Now, these are just three ways to look at this in a kind of a synthetic way. And when I talk about here until I get to the end, I'm going to focus on the one that's a 50% reduction below 1990. Now watch What you've seen before was already was to 2025 or 2030. I'm going to talk to you about that to 2050, so we're going to get somewhat different numbers, but I'm looking for insights, not detailed numbers. Now, what the behavior of these policies is in the United States depends a lot on what other people are doing. So I make particular assumptions about what's going on in other countries. One assumption, and that is that the developed countries are following a path very close to this 50% path that I just talked about, which is close to, in percentage terms, to Lieberman Warner. Others, meaning the developing countries, they don't do anything until about 2025. They begin to enter in 2025, and around 2030, 2035, they begin to take serious reductions, and by 2050, they've returned to 2000. All right? So you begin to get some big developing country action in around 2030, 2035. When we're following the 50% case, and when they're doing what's written in the little box, later at my last slide, I'm going to call that universal participation. I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back to that point. So, given this way of laying this out and focusing on this 50% case, I'm going to try to make four additional insights besides what we've talked about here. One is what about banking behavior? What's the potential effect of banking behavior, and what influences it? What might be the importance of trade effects? Terms of trade effects. What is the scale and pace of implied change? And I'm going to lean even more heavily on what Howard said. And then a question which I think was in some of the emails that were sent to Bob that people wanted to talk about is what's the consistency between these alternatives and the atmospheric stabilization target? I'll cover those four points. And the first point has to do with the role of banking in policy. And this is this 50% case. And if the agents in the economy don't really believe the long-term target, they're just facing the. By the way, if they don't believe that, they don't bank in order to anticipate higher costs in the future, then you would get behavior along this red line, relatively low cost, relatively low prices of CO2 equivalent now, but getting very high at the end. If agents were looking forward and really believed the targets that are written in some of these bills, if they really believed we were going to do that, then they would tend to bank now, incur additional costs now, save those permits to lower the costs later, and by this calculation, you would get something like $40 a ton CO2 currently. Now, the point is, there's a substantial difference, this may be overstated somewhat, but there's a substantial difference in the short term, depending on what you think the agents are going to think, the people making decisions are going to think about the credibility of the policy in the longer term. And this is a very important matter in the design, particularly when you're designing policies that you think are going to have to be adjusted over time. This is the banking issue, and one of the reasons you get different answers from these models is you make different assumptions about what do you think is going to be the behavior in terms of banking. In the case of the sulfur program, where permits were allocated over a long time in the future, so there was pretty good certainty about what the targets are going to be in the future. There was a set of banking behaviors that made the economists who studied it very happy. It looked like the agents had studied Equine and were behaving in that way, and that's what you would get here. But this is important in thinking about how the policy is going to work. What you're going to see in the short term is going to be influenced by the credibility of the longer term targets, and a lot of these bills have tightening in them. Do you believe it? Do you think they will believe it? That's the first point. Second point is trade effects. I'm not talking about buying allowances now. I'm talking about trade effects. And the first is what effects it matters what others are doing. And this is just to give you insight about what difference that makes. And here I compare two cases. This is I'm now in a banking world, and I'm now sticking with this same 50% case for a while. And here you have a case where if the United States does this by itself, and no one else does anything, it's a mental exercise. What would be the cost? You get the black line. What if everybody else was following what I put in the box? Then the price to achieve that level of reduction would have to be higher in the United States. Why? Because if everybody else is taking these policies, they're going to lower the prices of energy in world markets. And the United States is a major importer. So with lower fuel prices in the United States, you have to have a higher CO2 price to get the carbon out of the system. Very simple mechanism. The effect on terms of trade, which influences the consumption laws in the United States, a little bit more complicated. Terms of trade, what that means is if the relationship between your import prices and your export prices. If the price of your exports stay the same, but the price of your imports go down, for the United States, for example, that's good. That would be a benefit to the United States, called a term of trade gain, or could be another way, term of trade loss. What happens here, if the United States did this by itself, once again, thought exercise, then you would get the black line. If everybody else was following the assumption from the black box, early on, where you have a lot of action by other developing countries, then if they're operating in the market, it's a little bit more expensive for the United States, somewhat higher consumption loss. Mainly this is because we're competing with them for biofuels, which we're importing. We're importing a lot of the biofuels. When the developing countries begin to come in, according to the assumption I made, then you begin to get this effect through oil prices. And so the United States begins to benefit substantially through the lower oil and gas prices, and the welfare loss is less. This is just to make the point that what happens in the United States is influenced by what these other areas are doing. There's been a lot of talk about importing allowances, that is, credits or offsets. The only point I'll make is that whether those offsets are cheap or not is totally dependent on this question of what other people are doing. It's not hard to do an analysis where the United States is not buying the permits, we're selling them. It all depends what everybody else is doing. So it's not necessarily the case that the other countries are going to have permits that are at lower cost than the marginal cost of reduction in the United States. Next, the scale and pace of the effort. This is one scenario, one model, and all I want here is not the details, exact numbers, but the general idea. Here in the left-hand bar is the coal, oil, and gas use in the United States today. Of course, this is use, not production, because we're importing a lot of the oil, for example. And I only want to look at what this analysis says would be one scenario of what it would take to achieve the target, once again applied across all sectors, of something like Lieberman-Warner bill. So how are we going to do this? Well, one way is we have to get something out of the demand side. This is conservation, efficiency, what have you. So by this analysis, we get a good amount out of the demand side. The other two things, as have been emphasized before, is we've got to get it out of the transport sector, and we've got to get the carbon out of the power sector. In this model, the main way we're getting it out of the transport sector is with biofuels, which is the major push in the United States and Europe today. We're going to get the carbon out of the transport sector with biofuels, and in this analysis, we have a huge increase in the efficiency of the automobiles, miles per gallon. Well, the biomass implications of this, if we don't have some other way to get the emissions out of the transport sector, I would just say in this calculation, thought experiment, that with second-degree cellulosic ethanol would require all the current cropland of the United States. Just to give you an idea of the scale. The scale of this is huge, and we already see the biomass implications in every day in the newspaper at very small scale. We don't really understand, I think, 35 billion gallons, which is the current target, and this is much more than that if you were going to do this. The other thing I would point out is that we've held nuclear constant here. I'll come back to that in a minute. We have to replace, in this particular analysis, we get the carbon out of the transport, out of the system by the same way that these other models do, with carbon capture and storage. This amount of carbon capture and storage, if we started building the first plant, coal-fired plant with carbon capture and storage, if we could put the first one on the ground in 2015, that's very optimistic. If you could, this requires 400 plants. You'd have to build 1,000 megawatt plant with carbon capture storage every month for 35 years. Now, it doesn't have to be carbon capture storage. It could be carbon capture storage and nuclear. Or maybe we've underestimated the renewables, or maybe we don't have enough demand reduction. But it could be, maybe it's not 400 plants, maybe it's 300, or maybe it's only 200, but we're not on a path to build anything. So I just point out that we aren't really faced with the scale of this in terms of the allocation of effort across technologies. Final point. Then there's the coal industry. I just point out, by this scenario, what happens has to happen to the coal industry, and we can compensate certain folks in the coal industry, but there are railroads and states with revenues and labor and such. I just point out the difficulty there. It's obvious. Final point. What really matters in what we're doing? I take this case, and I take where people are in 2050, and I just extend those current levels of emissions out to 2100, just to get an idea of, would this 50% case achieve, what would it achieve? And here I just want to make one point. This is the no policy case. If you do nothing, by our analysis, you'd get carbon concentrations in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, somewhere around over 800, not an unusual number. If only the developing countries, as I described before, play this game and operate as I described in the box, that's what you would get. This is the simple point about the importance of the developing countries. If the developing countries would follow what was in the box, they just delayed for 20 to 25 years, still would be good. You got to get them on board. It's not so bad. By the way, there's 550. There's 450. We're going to blow through 450 without noticing, I'm afraid. Final point. This is universal participation. This is across the bills that I chose before. And that is the difference at the end of the century between the three levels that I described that we're fighting over now. So my point is that the difference between these bills in terms of their long-term goals, 187, 167, 187, the like, that's not what really is important. What's really important in terms of the scale of this problem is what's going on back here. It's what we're doing now to influence the likelihood that other folks will join in this. And it's much, what this aspect of these bills, whatever it is, whatever we can do, is much more important than one or another number in some long-term target.
Thanks very much again to Peter and Terry, and particularly Bob, for organizing this session. I haven't had many opportunities to talk about climate policy and climate policy modeling in Washington lately, so it's a real pleasure to actually have a chance to do so. I think in this panel I'm going to play the Dick Gettle role, so I'm going to kind of try to put the modeling results in perspective to some extent, although the modeling speakers have done a good job of that, and kind of go beyond the models a little bit into at least these models, into different kinds of models and things left out of the models. And actually that part of it I was going to conclude on some concerns about how robust some of the conclusions are that you've heard about. A lot of them I actually think are quite robust, others I'm not so sure about. But on the way here I thought of another going beyond thing, and that is going beyond Washington, D.C. It seems pretty clear to me that the lead on climate policy in the U.S. is now in the hands of the states. And I think that you could view as a good or a bad thing, being here in Washington. And I do think both in terms of policy development and analysis, there's a question that all of you in this room should be asking yourself, is do you want to fight that or take advantage of it? And I think you can do it either way. Obviously, I think taking advantage of it is a better kind of a partnership approach. I also think analytically there are a lot of things, and Dallas did a good job pointing in this direction, and Howard as well with the NIMBY issues. There's a lot of things that you can't really resolve very well at the aggregate level, and this has to do with local politics and NIMBY problems and so on. In fact, I can recommend two things that just got public this week. On Wednesday, there was a release of an analysis by Energy Environmental Economics, who's working for the PUC in California on rate implications of different implementations of AB 32, which is the Climate Act of California. And that actually gets down to a very detailed level, a seven-way split of the state, the three major investor-owned utilities, the two publics, and then aggregating some of the munis together. And that actually does look at things like renewable portfolio standards, not from the generic top-down modeling approach, but from where the companies actually think they might be able to site the wind, solar, thermal, and solar voltaic plants. The other thing is I'm part of this committee called the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee that reports to the California Air Resources Board. Our report, like it or not, is on the web this morning. I actually don't like some parts of it. Some parts I like a lot. It actually talks a lot about going beyond markets, which is a thing I'll touch on here. I think we don't really come back to what was artfully put forward in the Market Advisor Committee, was that is the advantage of using markets. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two is if you look at the models we've seen results from today, they are largely CGE models. We all know about CGE models or energy system models. And I think in other venues I've said in the past that these models are kind of good for 5 to 15 year, 20 year time period. Not shorter than that because they don't include unemployment and inflation generally. And not longer than that because of difficulties in incorporating technology. I think this group has really stretched those limits pretty far by working on issues like climate mostly, not even oil security, where you don't need to go out that far. I do think, and Dick did an artful job on this, that we're still working as a community on getting price-induced energy adjustments. I mean, basically we've got prices and quantities for energy and other inputs by sector. We kind of put them together, do some historical relationships between those and extrapolate them out. We've got some capital things that go on in between periods, but largely it's a substitution story. The question you have to ask yourself at the end of the day, even if you're not an econometrician, is how fast is structural shift going to overtake those coefficients, and therefore what kind of specification errors you might expect. I have no idea what the answer to that is. But I will give a couple of examples in kind of what might happen as we go forward in climate policy that might call that into question. So these models have historically been used for tax policy, trade policy, energy tax analysis, agricultural policy, and so on. And I think they have been artfully extended out to longer time periods and broader issues. But I think in the margin, as I'll indicate, I think I might not agree with some of the insights that come out of that style analysis. So uncertainty is important. Everybody's talked about that. I think the models provide useful insights and benchmarks. They actually like markets, but you have to remember that they're constructed around market paradigms, so it's not surprising that they like markets on the output side. That's kind of what goes in and comes out. And I actually think that's a good thing. As I mentioned in our ETAC report, I think the one thing we don't do is talk about the great advantage of markets, both in terms of getting price signals for individual decisions, phasing in new already developed technologies, and some inducement of advanced technologies. On the other hand, I think there is a need, particularly in this case, to go beyond that. And moreover, I think some of the states are going to go beyond that. It may be a good idea or a bad idea, but they're going to do it. So I think we got to get over that and actually take advantage of it to the extent that we need to. So I think there is a need to go beyond the models. They provide a useful framework, though, so we ought to do what we do in the context of the broader framework of the market paradigm. But we do have to recognize that some policy implementations are not efficient. Sometimes markets are not perfect. Sometimes externalities are not being internalized. A few simple examples can help illustrate what I mean. And then I'll come back to how robust the insights are anyway. Well, in the corporate planning literature, people say, well, you know, corporations today, Cisco, Google, and so on, face great complexity. So climate policy seems overwhelming to us at times, but it's probably no more overwhelming than if you were the CEO of one of these high-tech, high-velocity companies. So the strategy literature says, well, in cases like that, you've got to simplify a little bit to actually make progress and not be subject to paralysis by analysis, as we might call it here. My pushback to them, which I've done pretty aggressively, is, yeah, but how are you going to get those simple rules without looking at what the models say? So that's the context in which I think we ought to look at the models, is providing insights that we use as central elements in our thinking about this complex issue, but we don't ever sort of take, and everybody's actually admitted this, you don't take one model and think that that's going to solve it for you. So my simple rules thing, people always say, well, great concept, but how are you going to use this in climate policy? And this actually came out in part of the juxtaposition between Larry's committee and the committee I've been involved in on kind of putting the pieces together. So I think my prescription for policymakers is to rely on markets as much as possible, but correct the market failures that where they're pretty obvious that they are, where there are market failures. To carefully factor in the side benefits, this came up in the previous discussion, I won't spend a lot of time on that. I would pay attention to the states. They're doing a lot of experiments. Some of them will be successful, some of them will not. I think you can learn from both sides of that. And finally, this was already said by a couple of speakers, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good and useful, I think, starting with Larry, the first speaker today. So the simple rules folks base their whole theory on evolutionary theory, which says what you got to do is experiment a lot, kill off the bad ideas, and multiply rapidly the good ideas. So I want to give two examples here to drive home some of the issues involved. Some of you have seen this picture in California. We have electricity per capita flat the last 30 years, very different than the rest of the US. What's the reason for that? There's lots of contenders. They range from things like appliance standards and building standards, which people have exposed to analyze as uniformly advantageous in the public interest. Things like utility efficiency programs, a little bit more of a mixed bag, but largely advantageous. One thing to recognize in the details is in most states, there is not allowed, the utilities are not allowed to make the same rate of return on efficiency demand-side investments as they are on supply-side investments. California has fought for 30 years and has gotten there. That's explained a lot of this a gap. It is alleged by the people who study this that only three states actually have that so-called equivalence property. So there's 47 states to go there. Renewable portfolio standards have been somewhat effective, although there's been some bumps in the along the way. Renewable subsidies have been more of a mixed bag, sometimes quite effective, usually causing some learning, but sometimes at great cost. And industry migration, of course, is the big bad ugly. That we have seen some of, but by and large, this has been a pretty big success story. And here's some estimates of the more reliable part of this, which is about 30-40%. So this includes appliance efficiency standards, building standards, and utility efficiency programs. My second example is the automobile. This is a picture you've seen from David Green, I think, back here, because it's been testified to many times. And that essentially says, since the end of the CAFE standards becoming binding, there's been improvements in efficiency in automobiles, but it's mostly gone into bigger, badder, more ferocious vehicles. And if we didn't put them into those dimensions, we'd have 38 mile per gallon average corporate fleet efficiency at this point. The question is this a good thing or a bad thing? People have looked at the ex post analysis of these consumer decisions and discovered that the preferences are pretty fuzzy. So the word they use for this, that people really didn't know exactly what they were doing, even with the category of vehicle that they liked. And I think some leadership in Washington on this issue would be a good idea, because it's not clear to me that this trend since 1985 has been in the public interest, given that the preference for the bigger cars has not been that strong, and we've lost a lot of opportunities, both in energy security and in climate. This is another thing that David Green did that shows that if the consumers knew what they should know to make this decision on the energy efficiency side, they would already be at about 35 miles per gallon. So the concluding part of this is how robust are the insights? I think in terms of energy demand, based on what's actually going on in the states and thinking about some of the market imperfections and what's in the bottles, I'm really not sure that we won't see a lot more response on the demand side. Holmes Hummel, sitting here in the second row, has done a dissertation just looking at some sensitivities on the aggregate parameters. Nobody's really looked at this in great detail in terms of what it might imply, but I think based on some of the experiences in California and elsewhere, there's reason to suspect that the response to, or the alternative to Jake's point about both biofuels and sequestration being hard to ramp up by 2030 and 2050 is look harder on the demand side. I'm not saying that that's absolutely positively going to be the case, but I'm suspicious that it is. Fuel switching, okay. Sequestration and biofuels, many institutional challenges. There's an issue in the U.S. on pore space. Who owns the pore space? U.S. law says that if you own the surface rights, you own the pore space under the ground. This is an absolute potential disaster for development of sequestration, because we know that these fields are going to multiply out by a factor of 10 or 20 beyond the extent of the current oil infrastructure. In the long term, offsets become increasingly less important. I'm not sure about that. I think when we did the multi-gas study, I don't know who's doing this. I'm not sure. I think that probably just the nature of the numbers is such that they're going to go out. I think technology is important. Again, I think there's not much consensus yet on whether it'll be supply-side technologies or demand-side technologies on the one hand. And even amongst the renewables, I'm almost advocate of advanced photovoltaics, particularly if you allow distributed generation in your model, being a big player in the 2030 to 2050 time frame. Thanks. Sorry.
Take action, I think, in the near term the first 10 or 15, 20 years, the effects are not going to be substantial. And I think we run serious risks of great upheaval and difficulty in the trade regime, because this is a prescription for all kinds of mischief.
I would just add to that, I haven't looked at this issue for a long time, but as I recall, several years ago, there were real questions as to whether it would be possible to exclude imports of carbon-intensive goods from developing countries. I think developed countries have taken significant actions to raise the cost of carbon, but that there are at least some findings under the WTO. The main issue is that under the WTO, you can't exclude imports or penalize imports on the basis of process, or what's the other thing, process or input, something like that. But there have been some findings by the WTO that suggest that in environmental cases, the rule might not apply quite as strictly. But this is still to be seen.
Can I add just a couple quick comments? One is, I think the graph that was so interesting from Nick on delayed developing country participation relative to getting them in right away, in some sense, suggests that we do have, it's obviously very important, but we have some time in which to be convincing developing countries to play. And obviously the proposals for border tax adjustments or others are just one mechanism that can be used. On the narrow question of WTO admissibility, I agree with Bob that it's unclear the degree to which any such adjustments, either on a tax regime or on a cap and trade regime, would be WTO compliant. But I'd also note, of course, countries that violate the WTO rules, it's not that you're not allowed to, it's just you then have to pay compensation to other countries if you do so. So it's not an utter constraint, even if it is WTO non-compliant.
Just on the regional results that you presented with the EIA, did that include the differences relative contribution to both systems?
Well, put it this way, California shows small, well, California, I don't know what they are now. One of the problems with competitive is that competitive are really varyingly competitive, so I want to be careful what I say. But I think it's a lot of, the place where you want to get hit the hardest is a lot of whole and competitive. And, you know, and not a lot of whole. I think California showed pretty low on this thing, and they don't have a lot of whole. So I think they both agree.
Identify this question is coming from a CBO staff member, so that there's no misperceptions.
This question does not represent the views of CBO. I had kind of two questions for Jay here. One is, I was interested in your observation about the stringency doesn't matter as much as kind of getting things working initially so that the get on a trajectory that we're going somewhere. And I would just like you to develop that a little bit more in terms of thinking, what would be your recommendations about the types of policy designs, things we, a little bit more on what you think, how policies could be structured in such a way that kind of paves the way ultimately getting to, you know, the long-term objective. And I have then one more follow-up question on the supervision.
I mentioned three things. I think it's quite important the level and the kind of credibility of the commitment that we make.
Okay.
So if we do something that's kind of ad hoc and not very clear and doesn't seem to have a long-term legs, then it's, I think that's difficult. I think that thinking about what the effect is of what we do in giving credibility to others that they can feel free to move in this direction. And I would say the question of border tax adjustment. I don't feel confident to say very much about that, but I would like to raise the question, is that the right way to create a relationship with developing countries if you want to bring all of that? The other thing is that a lot of the discussion, I don't comment on anybody at the table or anything, but there's a lot of discussion here about the notion that we can find lots of cheap stuff abroad and lower the cost of meeting our targets here. Let's think seriously about how we think about that. That's a great point. The second point is R&D. What we're doing in R&D and developing nuclear and carbon capture and storage and all of those technologies, they are crucially important, not just for us, but for the world. And so I think doing more in that area would make a big difference in terms of the lack of liability. And the third point would have to do with just thinking of ways that we can think in our system that are politically possible that will give some more incentives in the short run. CBM has done some of that. But I think, you know, I wish I had a list of eight things, but I think that deserves a lot of thought.
In the certainty issue, is it better to have certainty about reductions or certainty about prices? Because that's, you know, what do you think about that?
It's better to have certainty about prices, in my view. Because the nature of this problem, I mean, maybe it's a longer answer than we have time for, but because of the structure of this problem, it being a stock part of the atmosphere, it's better to use a price mechanism and to have certainty about to the degree that you get certainty about the price of the cap. But my view about this is I don't think I'm not off theology about this. I think anything. Just do something. Anything that we can find. The other thing I would say is, I think a lot of when we talk about this overstates the difference between these two approaches. Because with adaptation over time, politically, that will be necessary as things that we learn in the U.S. and as things push us abroad. All these are going to be, these systems are going to be somehow modified over time. And so the difference between these two approaches is not as big as I think we tend to make it out of kind of pure.
Unlike Jake, I don't have a view on that, you say, but I would say say one thing, which is related to it, I think, which is that this issue of the ex post compatibility. I mean, obviously, any policy creates incentives, but it does strike me that, say, people who are interested in reducing greenhouse gas emissions may also be interested in other environmental problems or have certain technologies they like or don't like. And I think a real interesting question is, you know, if indeed this is the problem we want to focus on, you know, if it's an emergency, then, you know, to me, an emergency is something where you pull out the, you know, emergency means to do things that you wouldn't do if it wasn't an emergency. And there's really some question when you run these models again, you know, you kind of assume that you can build all this capital equipment and you have to build more as well as building stuff that people don't like. And I guess whatever policy is done, I don't think of it in terms of price or emission certainty so much, but I do wonder about, you know, putting something in place and then once that's locked in place, you know, based on, let's say, assumptions that you could build a lot of nuclear or a lot of coal with carbon capture sequestration. Sometimes I think coal with carbon capture sequestration is considered more acceptable than nuclear only because nuclear exists and coal with carbon capture. You know, but I think there's a real question here about, and that's what I was talking about ex post incentives. You know, this is not the only issue in the world. And that once this issue is settled, those other issues will come up and there'll be barriers to things. And I would worry a lot about designing policies, you know, given the height of the mountain we have to climb in terms of building stuff. I don't even want to say what the stuff is. That I worry about incentivizing people not to increase the height of those mountains. And I think that's pretty important. And whether that's price or quantity or what else needs to be done, I don't know.
Take a question over here.
Yeah, I guess this question regarding the relative importance of stringency of domestic caps versus sort of getting developing countries in the game. And I guess my question is, particularly with regard to CCS, does the stringency of the domestic caps may have a fairly significant impact on how quickly we're incentivized to roll out CCS, how quickly that happens in turn, and how quickly the sort of the cost of that is brought down will have probably a very large impact on developing country emissions. So is that sort of the fact of, you know, kind of getting this technology online and getting the cost brought down to a place where China and India can actually are more likely to use it? Is that a way in which the domestic caps may have a very strong effect on the overall success in the medium to long term?
Sure. Yeah. My main point was the need is to think more about this.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's very
important. My question is in regards to point of regulation in the U.S. I haven't heard of any compelling arguments for downstream regulation, but yet there's a lot of legislative proposals that go for downstream. Do you have any?
No. Actually, just like Larry Wilder of Dallas's Market Advisory Committee, California, actually had a lot of discussion of this. Larry, do you want to say something on this?
Well, I'll be brief. I think most economists tend to favor the upstream approach because it involves fewer points of regulation and thus lower administrative costs and also possibly easier monitoring. On the Market Advisory Committee, which is a committee I served on with Dallas and others to advise on the design of the California cap and trade system, there was much debate on this issue. In fact, the committee was split. There were 14 people on the committee. Three of the members were favoring upstream for the reasons I suggested. But the other 11 members favored downstream, and it turns out it was split along discipline lines. That is to say, it was just the economists on the committee that went for upstream. So I'm a little biased, I suppose, or at least my pedigree is showing. But I think that the main reason offered in favor of downstream, a couple reasons. One is we have more familiarity with downstream approaches because of sulfur dioxide, for example, regulations, or nitrogen oxides, and those for those kinds of emissions, you really do have to do it at point of combustion or downstream, because you can't do it based on fuel input. It depends on the process. The second reason, besides familiarity, and the other main reason, is there's this view that if you actually have to hold permits downstream and submit them as the point of regulations downstream, you're going to have more of an incentive to take action to find cleaner ways of producing. As an economist, along with my other economists on the committee, we didn't buy that argument because we felt that if you do it upstream, you have just the same incentive. This time it's coming through price changes. But there is a very different view, I think, there. There's a lot of currency to the idea that if you actually have to submit permits and you see them, you hold them in your hand, you're responsible, you're going to take more action, there's going to be big, bigger adjustments. So in some, I find the upstream approach more compelling, but there's a lot of folks, and many of them on my committee have been involved in developing REGI, for example, or the European Union ETS, that find these other arguments more convincing.
I would add one thing to that, but I'm not sure if this is correct, but it appears to me to be correct, and that is that so much of the emissions come out of the electric utility sector, and the electric utility sector is already regulated. The emissions are already regulated, a variety of emissions are regulated, and most of the industry is closely regulated at the local level, or state level. And so for a lot of people, it just seems sort of a natural thing that, EPA already, is already monitoring all these emissions that come out of every smokestack in the United States, so why don't they just monitor this one too? And it just makes more sense than doing things at that level because we already are doing them, we have the institutional structure in place. That said, I have never, ever, ever heard any economist ever say, oh, yeah, downstream.
In fact, you can draw the question because I think it would be fair to say that most economists would favor if they were to take action on climate and upstream tax which revenue is collected. And most of the policy discussion is a downstream cap and trade with a significant component of which the permits are given. So there are more dimensions than just upstream, downstream of this dichotomy or this difference of perspective.
Question over
here. Thank you. And I'd like to come back to discussion of developing countries. And when I started to work on climate change policy, only discussion in developing countries was how to get cheap compliance in Europe. And I appreciate very much shift in discussion regarding developing countries becomes more responsible. And idea to combine various sticks and carrots to involve developing countries, this is the only one way to grow. And then, of course, WTO. And when we're talking about taxation of imported goods or carbon levy or something like that, we may be in trouble with WTO rules. But what about if we require developing countries have carbon allowances to be kind of complement the import from the country? And instead of applying taxation, apply that kind of levy in terms of allowances. How it will work with WTO?
This is a proposal that's been around, I think, that involves them joining the system. That's it. They've got to have allowances, they have to have a cap. So then this proposal is to negotiate a deal where they get a cap with headroom, which is kind of, with headroom, and then they sell those permits, or they then see some price and we sell those permits if they wanted. We could buy them from them in some market. But they have to accept a cap.
That's right.
Then the question is, first of all, I'm not going to speak to developing countries where there's huge opposition to this, but then what kind of cap can we give them? Are we ready politically to give China a cap which is quite loose, so they have a lot of permits that they can then sell back to us, so that we can make them even more efficient in selling goods to us? There's a big problem with the international transfers that are implied here. But if you could do that, if you get a reasonable cap that was not too loose and such, and if we were politically willing to buy a permit, yeah, that would be, that would, I think that's a solution lots of people have proposed, and, but I haven't seen a lot of support for it among the countries.
Of course, before you apply such a rule that you will require them to hold some allowances before they can import something, then you won't have a lot of products. And federal allocation is a history.
Yes, I have a comment.
Maybe I misunderstand, but in my view, making it a cost of doing business is exactly what we want. We want them to be a cost of living. People like to try to save labor, they try to save other things because it's a cost of doing business. So I'm back to, I don't give Larry's economics lecture, but it's that same point that the price incentives are there. Again, I think that we overstate the difference between these two systems. If you, a lot of these systems that we're talking about in the cap and trade system are going to have some sort of, if you'll excuse the bad word, the safety valve. It now has a name which I can't remember.
Technology accelerator.
What it is a system within a cap and trade system to manipulate and provide some certainty and control over the price. And in a tax system, you would like to have as much certainty as you can get, but then if I'm in the wrong group, so you just talk about politics, but I'll just ask the question, this is likely the case, that in a tax system, if you're not getting what you want out of a tax system, it's going to be through pressure to raise the tax, or if over time, or is it going to be adjustment? Any tax system would have an adjustment. Any cap and trade system would have an adjustment. Overstate the difference between these two systems. There's a kind of theological economic reason to be in favor of taxes. But I think we overstate it in the way it would actually work under the type of law that we're like to agree to. But there can still be people who have a better view of that, and that's my impression.
Actually, I can add the California perspective again. This time we don't look as good. All the run-up to AB 32, all the analyses that were made public before me said it's not going to cost anything, and 24,000 new jobs were created. We've already had some discussion about why that's kind of a no-brainer. The reason I was highlighting this E3 report is for the first time this year later, there's now some actual talk about adjustments in costs. They're not huge costs, but they're definitely costs. So I would say cost/price transparency may be the most important thing. So either explicitly or implicitly, people know what these trade-offs are, and in that way they can align margins across sectors. If there's certain sectors you don't want to make pay as much, at least you have an idea of what the trade-off is there, as opposed to just saying the public wants the two-thirds story, but it'll all work out fine, and nobody will pay anything, which I think is maybe the way to start, but you can't get very far by having that philosophy.
Just a final thought. I would really be sad to see a huge amount of effort in the Congress and the country devoted to a debate over this issue, holding up doing either one of them.
I think we're going to have this very rare occurrence in which anything involving climate policy is actually completed on time or even slightly earlier than expected. So I want to just take this opportunity to thank the panel. Note that the slides from the presentations are up on the CBO website. And again, thank you to CBO staff for putting together such a terrific conference and all of you for joining us. Thank you very much.